Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome to this new episode of New Books in Economics, part of the New Books Network. I am Andrea Bernardi from Oxford Brookes University in the UK, your host of the channel. Today we will speak about a great visionary book on economics, but also political science. The title is Democracy and Growth in the 21st Century: The Diverging Cases of China and Italy, book published in 2019 by Palgrave Macmillan with two authors, Francesco Grillo and Raffaella Nanetti. Today we are with Francesco Grillo, Dr. Grillo, and he's reaching us from Rome. Welcome, Francesco. Can you tell us something about your affiliations and also of Raffaella, your co-author, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Andrea. Let me start from Raffaella, who apologized for not being with us today. She's a political scientist. She got her PhD at Berkeley, California. She joined Robert Putnam in a rather famous work introducing the concept of social capital, and brought with Robert Putnam at the early 70s book called Make Democracy Work.
Oh, wow, a masterpiece.
She then got involved with teaching and research at University of Chicago, which she's still professor emerita, and she's now teaching at Lewis in Rome. As far as I am concerned, I am, probably my background is more diversified than Raffaella's one, because I am born as a management consultant. I work with McKinsey. I got an MBA from BU, Boston University. Then I turned to political economy. I got my PhD at the London School of Economics. And since my PhD, I have been visiting University of Oxford, and now I'm associate to Sant'Anna University in Pisa. I'm still consulting. I'm managing director of a firm called Vision and Value, which is a spin-off of McKinsey. I am also a columnist of the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera. I run a blog with Guardian in UK, and I've been advisor of a couple of ministers of research school and universities in Italy. And I'm now considering my next move in academia.
Perfect, very good. I will tell to our listeners the structure of the book before I ask you my first question. So there are five big chapters. Number one, Introduction, Democracy, Innovation, and Growth. Number two, Making Democracy Work for Innovation. Number three, China, Advantages and Risks of the Entrepreneurial State. Chapter four, Italy, Simultaneous Crisis of Democracy, Innovation, and Economic Efficiency. And then a conclusion in the form of chapter five, Knowledge Democracy as Key to the 21st Century. So let's start. Can you tell us something about what is the book about and how did you put it together with your code, or how did you get the idea of this book?
Yes. Okay. Well, the book actually is the continuation of the strand of research that I initiated at London School of Economics with my PhD. My PhD thesis was titled Are public investment in research and development worthwhile, the taxpayers' money? And basically, the rather counterintuitive starting point of that research was that it is not at all automatic that spending more in research and development gets translated into higher economic growth. So my research at the LSE was basically about investigating the institutional condition, if you want, that makes the performance of public investment in research and development higher. And more specifically, I investigated the relationship between participation and performance of innovation policies at region level. I investigated the cases of quite a number of European regions, mostly in Spain and UK. I then wrote with Raffaella, in fact, a book out of my thesis in 2016. The book was titled Innovation, Efficiency, and Growth. So in a sense, the title is not very different from the book that we are talking about today. And basically, the book that I just published with Raffaella is, if you want, the scale-up of the same argument, the same framework at a global level. So instead of considering regions, I am considering countries. The book is not about China as in itself. It's not about Italy. It's about the relationship, the new relationship that probably is emerging between democracy, innovation, and economic growth. And China and Italy are two extreme cases that offer a very interesting, in our opinion, point of view to investigate what is happening to this relationship, which is basically at the heart of economic theory.
Very good. So in light of this continuation from your previous work, tell us about the very beginning of the book, chapter one, paragraph one, the innovation paradox. What is it and why it is so crucial in this book?
Well, the innovation paradox is, in fact, as you just said, very central to what we call the crisis of the West. And let me say that the West is, in fact, the core of the book. We are looking to China, we are comparing Italy and China, but basically our main concern, since we are not exactly China experts, is to understand a little bit more about the economic and even more the political crisis of the West. Our thesis is at the center of this crisis is what we call the innovation paradox. The innovation paradox is not an entirely new concept. Robert Solow in 1986 introduced the idea as the productivity paradox. Basically, the argument of Solow was why computers are everywhere but in productivity statistics. Basically, Robert Solow, the Nobel Prize, observed more than 30 years ago that notwithstanding the introduction of computers are everywhere, the economic statistics are not reacting in the way Robert Solow would have expected. After 30 years, this productivity paradox has become even bigger. if you look to the evolution of the information communication technologies, basically the capacity of the computers put together by the internet to store information, to transmit information, to compute information has increased of roughly 30% per year. However, productivity, so the value of each job at the end of the day, the growth of productivity has decreased steadily since more or less the time when Robert Solow was the first to notice this puzzle. And it is a puzzle, because if you have much more information, you should also be able to be more productive, because you better know which are the most productive ends to which allocate scarce resources. This does not appear the case, and it is not just productivity. So this is why we called the productivity paradox. We upgraded the concept of the productivity paradox to innovation paradox, because there are many other numbers, many other parameters, but more importantly, there is the feeling of the people in the West that technologies are not delivered what they promised.
And in defining this paradox, you have used the word puzzle, but there is another puzzle, the puzzle of democracy, as a determinant of this paradox. Can you elaborate on this point, which is in your book?
Yes. Well, the puzzle of democracy is at the same time the cause, but also the consequence of the innovation paradox. And as a matter of fact, there is also a rather clear evidence that you can find in the book. Basically, if you scatter countries of the world in a map according to their economic growth and their ranking in the democratic index, elaborated by The Economist, it seems that there is a rather strong negative correlation between degree of democracy and economic growth. Now, we in the book go beyond this empirical evidence, which can have quite a number of limits. And our observation is that, we are not talking exactly about democracy. Talking about the liberal democracy, which is a specific form of democracy, our observation is that liberal democracy procedures have been, how can I say, overwhelmed by this explosion of information. Liberal democracies seem not technically not able to produce the strategies, the infrastructure, the regulation, the incentives, which are absolutely necessary for a society to adapt to a mutation, we call it mutation, like the one that this new industrial revolution is producing. But this is the cause. On the other hand, a lower performance of economic system governed by liberal democracy make people more and more disappointed, because they feel that the promise of this huge technological progress are not being delivered. And this is a very strong feeling, especially among the middle class. There is also an additional problem with liberal democracies. The technologies themselves have bypassed the information holders, the media, the universities that we used to have as monopolies of information, and people can voice their disappointment much more heavily, and therefore these reinforce even more the crisis of liberal democracy. So in a sense, the innovation paradox and the puzzle of democracy reinforce each other, and to us this seems quite a convincing theory to explain the very many different crises of liberal democracy in the UK, in Italy, for the European Union, or in the United States.
So let's move to chapter 3, where you put in practice this theoretical framework talking about China.
Yes, well, everybody's talking about China as either the star of the so-called globalization, although we are now in a sort of deglobalization era, or as the big threat to the West. Let me first of all say that I believe that the book and we do not belong to any of the two ideological camps that are confronting each other when we talk about China. In other words, I have the impression that we have on one side people who think that China, as somebody has recently said in Washington, D.C., is an enemy which is even worse than Russia or than Soviet Union used to be. And on the other side, you also have quite a number of even Western intellectuals that almost say that even the snow in Beijing is more beautiful, like some people used to say about the snow in Moscow quite a number of years ago. I think we try to be as much as possible balanced. China is not paradise, and the Chinese are the first to say that they are not a model. However, if you look to numbers, talking about the productivity paradox, does not exist for China. Not only for China, this applies also to other Asian countries, but in the numbers of China are even more staggering. Just talking about the last 6 or 7 years since 2010, so talking about a period during which the economic growth of China has decelerated, as everybody knows, we can very clearly see that the entire economic growth of China is coming, in fact, from productivity. In 2010, the number of workers or people working in China was slightly less than in 2018. And yet, the economy has become twice as big. So the China is growing just because of productivity. The West is growing much less just because of an increase in the number of people who are working, a slight increase in the number of people who are working. So the productivity paradox does not exist for China. And the numbers for China are not just about economics, are about poverty. It's true that the economic development of China has been very unbalanced, producing large inequalities. But yet, if you look to the numbers of poverty reduction, two-thirds of the people in the world that went out of absolute poverty were Chinese. And also, if you look to very concrete numbers, like, for instance, life expectancy, nowadays, a Chinese, on average, lives more years than an American without chronic disease. There is this indicator calculated by the World Health Organization called the life expectancy adjusted for diseases. And Chinese today live longer than American, although American spend in healthcare 15 times more than a Chinese. So these numbers are quite staggering. The secret of China, well, I leave it to the reader to read the book and chapter 3. But if I can say in a nutshell, which is the big secret of China, is that they still have a state. They still have the capability to produce a strategy, to produce infrastructure, to produce regulation, to produce incentives so that they can adapt to the mutation of the fifth industrial revolution, as we call it. This is something that liberal democracy seem not able almost structurally to do. Just to give you a macroeconomic expression of such a thing, China, the real anomaly of China is that they have invested 40% of their GDP for the last 30 years. The percentage of GDP which is invested in countries like Italy is below 15%. So it's almost three times smaller. So China is has got the advantage of central planning, which is to make a very fast decision, and it has corrected the very huge limitation of central bank central planning through this practice of carrying out experiments. So they experiment everything before implementing reforms, before adopting in a widespread way technologies, and this is quite something that we can probably consider. Of course, the Chinese miracle must be qualified. To me, it seems that the strength of China is mostly relative to the weakness of the West, so it's not an absolute strength. And number two, they have, as Xi Jinping knows very well, some very significant vulnerabilities, or as Xi Jinping calls them, challenge. To me, the biggest challenge for China is, again, individual freedom. One may argue that freedom belongs to the Maslow pyramid of the needs of human beings. And sooner or later, people will ask more individual freedoms, and that will be, you know, a big challenge for that kind of political regime.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, another paradox is that if we read, for example, Why Nations Fail by Acemoglu and Robinson, we would be surprised to explain China's rise because this is happening without democratic institutions. So the good policies that you have mentioned, the ability of the state to do good regulations, is happening despite there is no freedom of press, freedom of speech, and there is no traditional liberal democracy institutions as we have been considering them essential to good policies. And this is a very, very paradoxical for
us. Yeah. Let me say that that you are totally right, and probably this is something that must be even underlined and emphasized. It is not just that China is a communist dictatorship. They among the five countries left who are still governed by a communist party, it's the only country that does not have a general national political election. Soviet Union used to have a national political election. China had the last general political election in 1919, so almost, 1 century ago, basically. You are totally right. It is a system which is opposite to what we call liberal democracy. However, what is interesting and still to be investigated is that they, in fact, have mostly within the Communist Party a rather intense collective problem solving, an internal debate, even among contrasting opinions and point of views, with the very clear rule that once some decision has been taken after a rather extensive consultation process to which also other parties, by the way, and other institutions, not only the Communist Party, contribute, that decision must be implemented. So they have a process through which individual intelligence is transformed into some form of collective intelligence. And our thesis in our book is that probably democracy, beyond the concept of liberal democracy, should be reinterpreted as something like that, a method, a process to transform individual intelligence into collective decision, which are smarter because they are shared.
This is very interesting. The next book I'm reviewing is by Professor Yuan Yuan Hang. The title is How China Escaped the Poverty Trap by Cornell University Press. And she argues that China is, yes, an authoritarian regime, but with democratic characteristics. And this is something that you are also arguing now.
I sort of agree.
Okay, so now let's move to chapter 4, which is instead about Italy as a symbol of the decline of the West.
Yeah, well, Italy is the mirror image of China, in a sense, which is quite paradoxical because China and Italy even share some traits. Probably China and Italy are the countries with the longest history, you know. And as a matter of fact, they also are the two countries with the highest number of UNESCO cultural sites. But beyond these common traits, their performance has been just the opposite. Just to give you one number, whereas China in 1989 was the poorest country of the world in terms of income per capita, this is a rather surprising number that we detail in the book, and now is the largest economy of the world if we compute numbers in purchasing power parity. They even became bigger than the United States, in fact. Italy did just the opposite. In 1994, Italy was the fourth largest economy of the world. Today is in position number 8 or number 9, and it's sliding farther. So basically, the two trajectory were just the opposite. In a sense, Italy is also very interesting. I suggest people, readers, to read the book on Italy, because it has been a laboratory of a crisis, economic, political, but also, I would say, unfortunately, cultural crisis, which has then contaged the rest of Europe, and not only the rest of Europe. Donald Trump very easily acknowledged that Berlusconi was his model. And UK, in a sense, UK crisis, UK, impossibility to understand the British politics nowadays sort of resemble the much older impossibility to understand Italian politics, you know, that that we both know. So Italy is a very, very, very interesting. Just one number to say how Italy is different from China. Italy, Italian government spend on pension, on retirement benefits, four times more than it spends on education, from kindergarten to universities. The very opposite happens to China. The Chinese government spends in education four times more than it spends in pension, for very different reasons. And by the way, it's not even true that the age structure in China is so dramatically different, you know, because China is aging quite fastly. The reality is that that Italy is spending in the past four times less than it invests in the future, and just the opposite is happening to China. So again, Italy is the mirror image of China, because there is, very little strategy. And this is something that does not change that much, even when government change dramatically. Very little strategy, very little infrastructure, very little capability to regulate new phenomena like the digital platform, which are really changing a lot, and very little incentives for making technological progress more acceptable, and, for instance, managing the inequalities that technological progress create. But again, Italy is very much just extreme case of what is happening to Europe as a whole, and to the West, if we add the United States to the European Union.
Good. Let's move to the conclusion, almost the conclusion of the book. Chapter 5, page 264, you have an interesting chapter with 10 ideas for developing knowledge democracy as a solution to the innovation paradox. Maybe you can list the most important, or very briefly, all of 10.
Yeah. Okay. Let me first of all again say that I hope the reader will read the ideas. One distinctiveness of this research and that will continue is that we do not just observe problems. We also try to advance some proposals, some ideas. The main message of these ideas is to transform democracy from a system where people just vote to a system, probably I should say almost to an information system, which is able to gather, as we said before, individual intelligence into some form of collective intelligence. So we call this idea knowledge democracy. By the way, let me also say that there are some Western countries that are experimenting forms of knowledge democracy. We refer to Estonia, to Switzerland, of course, Australia, Canada. And coincidentally, they also are doing much better in terms of economy and innovation vis-a-vis countries like Italy. The ideas. Well, we, for instance, talk about a qualification of the right to vote and the right to be voted. If we move to a paradigm of knowledge democracy, probably the one head, one vote taboo must be reconsidered. We also are talking about combining in institutional innovation with technologies that make many things which were impossible today possible. Just to give you another small idea that we happen to discuss, the two of us, Andrea, one idea is to create, to give the possibility at the next European election, election for the European Parliament, to people to even choose to be part of a European-wide constituency and not just necessarily constituency that are bound to specific place, whereas nowadays people are moving more often, and therefore not necessarily they are bound to a specific city. This would mean to allow people to electronically choose beforehand whether they want to be part of a European-wide constituency or a constituency linked to their territory. There are other ideas, and we really hope that there be debate on those ideas, because we believe that the debate on how to reform liberal democracy is necessary for liberal democracy to survive to its own obsolescence.
Yes, to read all the 10 ideas and also to read about the secret of China, which is explained hiddenly in chapter number 3, you need to buy the book. So, yes, our listeners.
Absolutely.
I can ask you about your next book. So, do you have any current project?
What I can say that probably the next book will be even more specifically on the innovation paradox and how to solve it. So it will be about how democracy can adapt to this technological revolution, which is probably even bigger than the big industrial revolution that we have witnessed in the past. The characteristic of this research is that it is very much interdisciplinary, as it is evident. So it's not just about economics or political economy. It's also about political science and innovation management. So I really hope that there will be other researchers like you, Andrea, or Raffaella, to network with each other. I'm very curious to explore more China, and I'm going to Beijing next July to teach at UIB Business School in Beijing, and I also want to start learning some Chinese together with my daughter. And so we hope that one idea would also be to convince somehow the European institution to make much more experiments before adopting transformation reforms that need to be tested because we are navigating uncharted waters, I would say. So this is more or less the rather wide plans for the future.
Well, good luck with this project. And in the meantime, congratulations for the book that you have just published. I see on the cover of the book amazing endorsements from Romano Prodi, Bill Emmott, colleagues from Chinese Academy of Social Science, colleagues from Stanford. So I'm sure this will be a success. We have spoken with Dr. Francesco Grillo about his latest book, Democracy and Growth in the 21st Century, The Diverging Cases of China and Italy, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2018. Thank you very much for being with us.
Grazie, Andrea. Thanks.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.